Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we return to some of the underlying issues on the continuing community outrage over the killing of Saheed Vassell, a black man apparently suffering from mental illness from Crown Heights, who was shot by the NYPD last Wednesday when officers responded to a trio of 911 calls regarding a man wielding what appeared to be a gun, and what appeared to be a firearm was in fact a curved metal pipe. So how did a man known to his community and its police officers end up in such a fatal situation? And what options does New York City have to prevent other deaths like this one? That's our focus now with DJ Jaffe, Executive Director of MentalIllnessPolicy.org, an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Insane Consequences, How the Mental Health Industry Fails the Mentally Ill, and Michael Biasotti, former president of the New York State Association of Chiefs of Police and the current head of its Untreated Severe Mental Illness Committee. Welcome to WNYC Today, DJ and Michael. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for bringing this issue to the public's attention.
Yes, thank you very much.
DJ, last week you published an op-ed in the New York Post arguing that Saheed Vassell, as well as Deborah Danner, the mentally ill woman who was killed by police in the Bronx last year, could have been subjected to Kendra's Law. Briefly remind us again, what is Kendra's Law and why did you bring it into this conversation?
Kendra's Law is only for a very small group of the most seriously mentally ill who have been offered voluntary treatment, refused that treatment, and become homeless, arrested, incarcerated, or violent as a result. For that tiny group, it allows judges to order them to accept treatment while they continue to live in the community. And that's important because it's less expensive, less restrictive, more humane than inpatient commitment or incarceration. And it reduced homelessness, arrest, incarceration in the 70% range.
Michael, are you on board with this?
Our Chiefs Association, the state, strongly supports Kendra's Law. We think it's an answer to reducing the amount of interactions that law enforcement have with severely mentally ill to begin with. And I mean, the best thing that you can do is reduce the number of times that there's an interaction between the two. I mean, that is the ultimate avoidance of any of these issues. And I do agree that it's not used nearly enough in the cases that require it.
And of course, that brings up the tricky question of how much do we incarcerate people? I shouldn't say incarcerate because it's not jail, but how much do we hospitalize people against their will? And last Friday, I asked Mayor de Blasio, DJ, to respond to your op-ed, and here's part of what he said.
I think this fits, unfortunately, with a right-wing message around the country. You see it coming from the Trump administration, too. The only thing they want to talk about in terms of mental health is people who should be institutionalized. Well, let's remember something. Institutionalization didn't work out so well. We had a tragic history for decades where people were sent away who never should have been, who could have gotten help and could have stayed with their families. It's a very small percentage of people who need institutionalization.
And the mayor went on to say that a lot of people who end up in these tragedies would never have been subject to that kind of treatment, to good ongoing treatment under Kendra's Law. So, DJ, what's your response?
First of all, I'm not a conservative. I do work with Manhattan Institute because they have been terrific on this, as have many conservative groups, many police groups, and many others. The mayor on your show also claimed that the majority of his $850 million Thrive New York City budget is going to the seriously ill. But his mental health commissioner, Dr. Gary Belkin, told the Staten Island News that only $165 million of the $850 million, in other words, 20%, is going to the seriously ill. The mayor has been really good, and again, I'm a Democrat, so I'm not a hater, but he's been really good on using the funds to improve mental wellness in the masses, and he's funded pop psychology programs, but he has virtually avoided treating the seriously mentally ill. And he claims that his big advance is he has a phone number people can call. Well, first of all, having a phone number is no big whoop. Most of us have one. But the other issue is that if a family calls and says that my mentally ill relative is in crisis, needs help right away, it takes 2 days for them to send out an outreach worker. And if they, and they'll ask you, they'll say, if he's dangerous, call police. So the number's virtually useless.
And listeners, we welcome calls from anyone. Maybe you're in Crown Heights and you have a direct connection to Mr. Vessel, who was killed, or you've been participating in the protests against the way this went down. Also, anyone listening who's had experience with Thrive NYC, has the mayor's mental health program benefited you or someone you know, or have you had contact with it and found it lacking, or for that matter, had occasion to come into contact with Kendra's Law in any way, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for DJ Jaffe, Executive Director of MentalIllnessPolicy.org. And Michael Biasotti, former president of the New York State Association of Chiefs of Police and the current head of its Untreated Severe Mental Illness Committee. Michael, do you have an opinion on Thrive NYC and whether the conversation is going in the right direction here as far as you're concerned?
Well, it's very disappointing to hear the mayor turn it into a political, conservative, liberal position, which further, can't be further from true. It's about getting the most seriously ill help when they need it before they become a law enforcement issue. Kendra's Law does not hospitalize people. In fact, it's an outpatient treatment program, keeps them in care on the street. But what it does is it prioritizes and makes sure that the most seriously ill get their services first so that we don't run into these issues. And the problem law enforcement has, I mean, I was in Columbia's emergency room not long ago, and you can see 30 people standing in the corner, and the mother of one said this was a Friday night. She'd been there since Wednesday. He's severely ill. They don't have bed space. And what happens with law enforcement, we bring them to the hospital. The hospital takes them, if they're lucky enough to be admitted for the 72 hours, and they put some kind of treatment in to get them into some kind of treatment, they're released because there's no bed space to keep them. Now they come right back to the same situation they're in. They have not been stabilized because proper medication would probably take 3 weeks or more to get a blood level, and they're right back to the situation they were in, and they're still not stabilized. And it's because we don't have the bed space to get them stabilized properly before they return them to the same situation they came from. And the police, you know, next time they come, it's a jail run. It's not going to be back to the hospital. They've already been there and been released. So it's very frustrating because, you know, it is an outpatient treatment program. And it's not forced medication. And there's just a lot of misunderstandings about what Kendra's Law is. And the important thing is that it gets the services to the most ill first. It triages. And that's, I think, what we need to do. And that will, if anything, should reduce the number of interactions that we have now.
How do you, as former president of the New York State Association of Chiefs of Police, react to the more prominent public conversation that's been taking place, which says police officers need better training in de-escalation, or in this case, maybe getting information in a, and I realize it was an emergency response situation, but from the community police officers on the ground who knew this man and would have had reason to think he wasn't actually a threat or actually brandishing a gun, and that the chiefs of police of New York State, as well as everywhere else, should be looking inward in terms of best practices to prevent things like this from happening again.
Well, and that's interesting because New York City, I understand, does de-escalation training in their basic academy, which we in the New York State Chiefs have been pushing for and get pushback from the state to make it a curriculum course, the 40-hour de-escalation training as a part of the basic school, so that officers, when they come out, are sensitized to this issue and it becomes a part of the culture, a culture of the profession moving forward. However, there's pushback to it from the state level to say that, you know, it's an unfunded mandate. But as this problem grows, it becomes more and more of an outcry that something needs to be done. and it's unfortunately not happening. But I will also say that it's also not going to solve everything. There are a lot of cases, and I believe this is one of them, that, you know, a call of a man with a gun and a unit is responding. The first unit responding is going to go. You often don't have time to send a psychiatric response unit if it's life-threatening situation. And when they arrive on the scene, the escalation is great if you have time for it. But often these things happen within seconds upon arrival, and an officer's making a split-second decision that, yes, that metal object being pointed at me as if it were a gun is not a gun, and I'm going to risk my life to hope that I can talk that gun away. And they end in three ways. They end that the officer is shot and killed, and we'd be having a funeral today, or the suspect is shot and killed tragically that wasn't a gun, and we'd be going through what we do today. Or not to mention the many, many, many cases that NYPD has that are successful. The mentally ill person is dealt with and successfully got to the hospital, and then thrown back on the street to try it out again. I mean, that unfortunately is what we go through in law enforcement. And it's not particularly the state. It happens nationally.
The NYPD steps in when one condition is met. The mental health system failed. Last year, NYPD went on 165,000 EDP, emotionally disturbed persons, calls. It's also a little ridiculous to say that a community-trained police officer would have known that he's not dangerous. His own mother, who lived with him, had called police multiple times because he was dangerous. The police successfully took him to the hospital, only to find the mental health system released him without appropriate follow-up care.
But what about race as a factor here? Because this incident comes at a time when the country is grappling with mass shootings conducted almost solely by white men. And a response on Twitter that we saw points out that Dylan Roof, the Charlotte church shooter, and Nicholas Cruz, the Stoneman Douglas shooter, were all taken alive by police officers. Michael, do you want to reflect on that for us?
Yeah, I think that's absurd. No officer wants to pull his gun out in any situation. I mean, to think that a police officer wants to be involved in a shooting and are going to shoot someone because of their race or color is absurd. And I just honestly don't think that that deserves a reply. Nobody tries to, no police officer that I'm aware. And that's what we have a court system for. And I think that the photos that were and I'm sorry, this doesn't happen just in New York. In 2016, a similar case happened in California that we spoke about not long ago. Calhoun, California, same thing. It wasn't a gun. But even if it was a mentally, even if it was a CIT-trained officer who got there or the community officer that knows him, would that community officer known and that wasn't a gun that was being pointed at him? I don't think so. And that's going to, the ending would be the same. Now, if you have a situation where you can speak to the person and there's not an imminent threat, yes, send all the resources right. You can and do everything you can. But I don't think this was the case.
The question there is implicit bias, not explicit bias.
The first of all, New York City data says that blacks suffer serious mental illness at a rate less than whites, which is fairly absurd. There's no one who believes that, but it's another one of these ridiculous things believed by New York City. 29% of all officer line of duty deaths, a death of a police officer during a call, were on mental illness-related calls. After the shooting, and I'm sorry I don't remember the gentleman's name, in Baltimore, the Black Lives Matter group asked for an investigation.
Freddie Gray.
And there was an investigation, and it found that 40% of all police shootings were shootings by police involved mentally ill people. So yes, the shootings are of the mentally ill, and the black population is disproportionately underserved. That probably accounts for any bias.
Annette in Laurelton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Annette.
Hi, good morning. You know, my son has been suffering from mentally, as I said, order for years. First of all, I think the situation has to be, I have never called the police first. I always call for, when somebody's sick, you call for an ambulance. It's very important that they come because, believe me, the fire department, the EMS workers are more effective than quelling a situation. And then the police, if it's getting out of hand, then they show up and it's coordinated. But if you just call the police and you're all excited with them, that's the problem. Number two, I am not, as far as the mayor and his wife, I think they've been doing a great job. In Queens, you have Jamaica Hospital. They have a crisis unit that if you call them, they also will help you out. And finally, funding is very important. I feel now they're putting the emphasis on the opioid and not putting emphasis on the mentally ill and who are not on any kind of drugs besides their medication. Now, did they have a day program, an outpatient program at Creedmoor? There's some buildings that have been closed up for a long time. I know the state is responsible for opening up housing for the mentally ill. Where's that funding? Why I didn't hear the governor speak anything about the mentally ill.
Right.
That's
so
swept under the rug. You need more funding because you need to have really a wellness complex for the mentally ill, not putting them away, but having a wellness, I would say, a complex that to treat the people in a respectful manner.
I hear you, Annette. Thank you very much. So, Chief Biasotti, is this consistent with what you were saying before about not enough facilities, not enough treatment available for people in severe mental health situations? And what about Annette pointing to the governor and lack of state funding? Do you see it in the same respect?
Yes, I totally agree with her, especially her first point. Police should not be the first responders when not needed for a mentally ill call, for a person suffering with some kind of mental illness issue. However, that's not always the case. If violence is involved, then often they are the first person's calls. Many ambulance services won't respond if it's a mentally ill person who's in a violent situation unless they're accompanied by law enforcement. But yes, they are certainly should be the first one responded. And money, when you talk about New York City, I don't think money is an issue when it comes to mental illness. The funding is there. It's just not being spent properly. I believe that it needs to be prioritized. It needs to be triaged, and more focus should be spent on those seriously mentally ill. And bed space, to her point, what happens is the doctors are trying to determine, since such limited bed space, who are going to be on your radio next week talking about if they release, and who can we make a bed for? Because they have to get rid of somebody to put a new person in. So they're trying to make a guess as to who is going to be less in crisis if we release them. And that's just a dangerous situation to be. We don't have the bed space to properly stabilize.
DJ, that's consistent with part of what you wrote in your op-ed about the Mayor's Thrive NYC mental health program, that it's more focused on what you called the worried well than the seriously disturbed.
Right. And in fact, right now in New York City, there's a plan to close the psychiatric unit at Allen Hospital up in Inwood. And the mayor should be fighting that tooth and nail, and he's been missing in action. Governor Cuomo continues closing psychiatric beds like the ones your caller mentioned at Creedmoor, Staten Island. What we're doing is we're pretending everyone, even the most seriously ill, can live in the community. Many can, some can't, and we are oblivious to those. What I noticed when the mayor was on your show, he didn't even use the term mental illness. He talks about mental health condition, as if admitting to mental illness is a pejorative not to be used in polite company. The meaningful metrics we should be working to bring down are homelessness, arrest, incarceration, suicide, and needless hospitalization. The mayor's management report does not measure any of those. It measures how many calls come into a helpline, which can be done and is done by increasing his ad budget.
Rayanne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rayanne.
Brian, thanks for taking my call. I have gotten a court order for my daughter. This has been an ongoing issue of treatment and over the years. And Kendra's Law does not mean that the person will get treatment. once you can get them to the point where they haven't skipped out of the burrow, because otherwise if they skip out of the burrow, you have to start all over again in another burrow. So if you can happen to intercept the person, then they go before the judge, then they go for evaluation, not necessarily treatment. So it's a flip of the coin all the way along. If as what happened with my daughter, the intake psych ER decided that, yeah, she should go in for treatment. She was, but then released with no transition plan. To say that she was stabilized and could move back into the community is absurd. So over and over and over again, and we're talking about more than a dozen hospitalizations over a period of many years, it has always, always, and this is not just, you know, current administration, it's always fallen apart in what happens after the hospitalization. The transition plan, what kind of transitional housing, it's pretty much non-existent, and the waiting list is very, very long, and a person has to be pretty much homeless and have been on the list and somehow managed to organize themselves enough to get on that list. Secondly, the most recent intake was through my local precinct. I went in to talk to them, and I said, would I be better off? I know what it's like to go for Kendra's Law. I don't have that kind of time. So I went in. I said, should I call 911 or should I just, I just wanted to talk to you about what's going on. They pulled up a history. They listened to me, and they said, we're going to follow you home. We're going to go back with you. They had just had training recently, maybe a few days before then. And they went in and they spent hours to talk her quietly down the stairs and out and into what they called the bus, you know, that was the EMT that they called. And I wanted her taken to Bellevue, not some of the other places that have been really failures in Brooklyn City. And she was treated through the ACT team at Bellevue, and that worked pretty well for a while. And then that fell apart again after she was off court order.
So you're talking about problems both with intake, although it sounds like you were talking about a successful situation where they had training and spent the time for hours to talk her peaceably.
Absolutely.
And into the quote unquote bus, but then raising a big problem with what happens upon release, where there isn't the follow-up for kind of halfway housing and things like that.
Exactly right. And this is where very often there's no transition plan. It's also happened where social worker, many social workers, and this is in upstate New York, in various places in New Jersey, upstate, downstate, and in the hospitals in Brooklyn and Manhattan, so I have some experience in these matters. Yes. They don't call you. They don't always call you if they're going to discharge your child, if your child happens to be over 21.
Yes. Rayanne, thank you so much. I think that was very revealing, DJ. And maybe it points up another political problem, which is whether to take somebody in or release them might be of political interest to the political powers that be. But setting up the mechanisms for outpatient treatment after a release and appropriate housing with appropriate services, that just doesn't grab the politicians in the same way.
Right. The she pointed to, and I had the same experience, my sister-in-law was mentally ill, was in Bellevue, and they released her to my custody, and they didn't tell me that she had schizophrenia, what medicine she was on, what program she was supposed to get to, so I couldn't arrange transportation. I couldn't see that she took her medications. Families are considered the pariahs.
So to that point, and Chief Biasotti, this is going to be the last question. Next Thursday on this show, and I think you might have referred to this before, we will have Alyssa Roth on her new book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. And in her recent op-ed in the Daily News, she made the argument that Rikers is one of the three largest providers of psychiatric care in the country. At any given moment, more than 40% of its population has a mental illness. Around 10% have serious mental illness. So as Rikers prepares to close in the coming years, I wonder what you think should happen with its mentally ill population or future inmates who are in that situation.
Well, we as our association argued when Kendra's law updates were done, I think in 2015, that we asked that they screen persons who are prisoners in jails before their release, who are receiving psychiatric treatment while in jail, to be considered for appropriateness of Kendra's law, so that their services and they can be followed post-release with their services, because that's where the issue is. The issue happens at a jail level, not at a state prison level. The determination of the governor's office was he made it applicable to state prison, which is great, but it's not, doesn't help the main problem. The main problem is a revolving door that happens at the jail level. So no matter where they go from Rikers to what facility, if we're not screening them upon release when they're receiving psychiatric medication or treatment in jail, we're just greasing the revolving door that goes around. And we also asked, much to what DJ was saying, that they amend HIPAA so that families can partake in the most seriously ill's treatment, so we can get them to visits when they have to, and that kind of thing, so that we're not involving the police or waiting until they deteriorate, that it becomes an immediate emergency.
And
weren't successful.
If I can just say, the population of Rikers is going down. Both the number and the percentage with serious mental illness is going up. Thrive New York City's failing.
Michael Biasotti, former president of the New York State Association of Chiefs of Police and current head of its Untreated Severe Mental Illness Committee, and DJ Jaffe, who spoke last there, executive director of mentalillnesspolicy.org, an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute Think Tank, and author of Insane Consequences, How the Mental Health Industry Fails the Mentally Ill. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.